Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the authors and editors discuss news and events with a splash of history. Our host today is Dan Masterson. Joining him is Jim Dunnigan, well-known military author and the Dean of Wargaming. Also, joining today's show is columnist and author retired Colonel Austin Bay.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Austin, you wrote a column that it was on being able to fight two wars. Is that correct? Is that...
Well, I wrote one about U.S. preparing to fight two major wars simultaneously, one to the east and one to the west in the Indo-Pacific. But I've done two columns down in the last 6 weeks about disintegrative warfare techniques, operations, tactics that tear down a major adversary. The term, as far as I can tell, first comes into use in the 1990s by a historian and a social scientist, saying that a society's torn down incrementally by an opponent. But understand that's been done before. You think of the Opium Wars, Britain introducing opium to China, and the growth of addiction, weakening literally weakening the country, making a substantial number of citizens dependent on opium. It's been done by, if you look at the quote unquote agricultural war, where you destroy the other side's crops, salt the fields, that starves the country out over a long period of time. It might not be one act, but it would be part of a weakening an opponent, and that's been done, as far as I can tell, since the beginning of the agricultural revolution, which would be roughly somewhere between 9 and 12,000 years ago. But what is arguably going on, I think arguably it's evidently going on, is, and I primarily China would be behind it, is being disintegrative warfare is being directed at the United States. And you see that in the fraying of the social safety net by illegal immigration. And you see it by the increase in deadly drug deaths. You also see it in some ways about the economic distortions of non-productive parts of the economy are become bloated. I'm talking about the certain kinds of welfare and government programs. You could say those are self-inflicted. Yes, could be, but they could also be encouraged by within the political system, by information warfare, by an adversary that says over time this will weaken a very strong adversary. The strong adversary being weakened be the United States, with China using these techniques. But that is what I see, and I'm not the only one who sees that going on vis-a-vis the United States and its various adversaries, but primarily China, and, well, Russia using information warfare techniques to try to stall or blunt U.S. policy, which Russia did throughout the Cold War in the guise of the Soviet Union with disinformation campaigns. But we've reached a situation where the United States faces the prospect of fighting two major wars simultaneously, with two large theaters is the way to describe it. And we started using the World War II configuration of ETO, European Theater of Operations. And remember, that included North Africa and parts of the Near East. The Pacific Theater of Operations, which ran, it's really what the U.S. basically calls now Indo-PACOM, because it included operations in India, as the Japanese made forays into the Indian Ocean, and also definitely land operations with the British and Indians, and a few scattered American units and Chinese units fighting Japanese forces in Southeast Asia and in China, and in right on the doorstep to India. So those were two major wars simultaneously. Were they linked? Well, yes, but you see, also see historically the way it was fought, that all of these, the Pacific is primarily a naval war. The Atlantic, yes, it's an anti-submarine war and an air war and ground combat. But it was, the United States had the industrial base at the time to wage that war and wage it successfully. There's been a degradation of the U.S. Industrial base since the end of World War II. Some of the decisions made within the United States, but also, well, quote-unquote, offshoring, as that industrial production and manufacturing can be moved to other nations. In some cases, it's practical, economically rewarding. In other cases, where you have certain industries that are very, very critical to defense, it's a mistake to have most of your really advanced computer chips being produced in, and I'm speaking really both reality, addressing reality, but also theoretically, having Taiwan produce your most advanced computer chips, because right there, you know, under the guns of communist China. And the article on two theaters also has ties into discussions that were held right after the end of the Cold War. Do we need to have as large a force as we did it during the Cold War, still facing the USSR and facing communist China, and peace dividend kicked in, suddenly the army's shrinking. The Navy is shrinking more slowly, at least initially, and you know, we're not devoting as the U.S. is not devoting as much money to its defense budget. But then you ultimately pay a price if you have, and here's one of the critical examples is merchant ships weren't being made in the United States anymore. South Korea and Japan were making them, which fine. China picks up and starts building lots of commercial ships, and the United States shrinks to, well, we're lucky sometimes if we can build 12 to 20 commercial ships, and that ultimately affects your ability to build naval vessels, combat ships, warships, and combat support ships. Yeah, you lose the skills. And there's a disintegration effect there, so that you can't wage that those wars for national survival. And they would be, you know, especially the one in the Indo-Pacific. It would be a war for national survival, like World War II. And I ought to finish what I was going to say about the thinking after the end of the Cold War, is that, well, wait a minute, we don't need to be able to refight World War II. We can win one and hold, win and hold, hold, and then we move all of our forces to the other theater and win there. Well, we may not be positioned to do that now. And you pay a very heavy price if adversaries decide to risk it and see if they can pull it off. And that was the idea behind that column that you were referring to on the two. But they link in, that column links in to the two I did on disintegrated warfare.
So, Jim, can the United States wage a two-front war or a war and hold? And well, do we need to?
Well, yes, we're already doing it. Russia is the main threat in the Atlantic, and they've been neutralized. They lost most of their fleet, their Black Sea fleet, to USVs, unmanned seagoing vessels. These were the sea babies, as the Ukrainians call them. And they basically, without a fleet, destroyed a third of the Black Sea fleet and drove the rest of them as far away from, the main Ukrainian port of Odessa as humanly possible. And even then, the Ukrainians are using the USVs to attack the refuge ports that the remaining Black Sea Russian fleet is sitting in. So they're under constant attack. The Ukrainians, as often happens in the wartime conditions, become very innovative. And they have basically developed these USVs, unmanned seagoing vessels, which are incredibly cheap to build. You know, in large numbers, we're talking $20,000-$30,000 a piece. Now, these things carry explosives. They could also be used equipped with sensors to go for surveillance and reconnaissance. And there have been pictures of, for example, two of these USVs destroying a Russian frigate in the Black Sea. And they damaged several other Russian ships. And this prepared the Russians to get out of Crimea, leave Sevastopol and take their fleet as far away as possible. But the Ukrainians are sending their USVs after them. And so, you know, the Russians are not only driven out of the Black Sea, but their remaining ships are under siege, as it were, under attack, wherever they go, in the distant parts of the, by the Georgian coast and what have you, the Sea of, I forget the name of it. Anyway, it's a large body of water, the Black Sea, and most of it's, up in the northeast. And this is where the Russians are hiding out. But there's no escaping from the punishment the Ukrainians are visiting upon them. Now, you got to remember, Ukraine does not have a fleet. They have these USVs. And this is a remarkable new weapon. Now, the United States has picked up on this, and they realize that if they produce hundreds, or a couple thousand, of these USVs for Taiwan, Taiwan could stop any Chinese invasion, because they just deploy these USVs. They're very difficult to spot using sonar or radar. They're low in the water, they're non-metallic, and they're deadly. You can jam their control signal, but they also have a backup, which basically locks on to their target, with their own sensors, image sensors, and it will keep going. And that's something that's been used, for a long time for anti-tank weapons. This gives the Ukrainians or the Americans, if they use it, or the Taiwanese actually, a big advantage, because the Chinese could not fight their way through this basically sea full of mobile mines, is what they basically are, and they're under control of the Taiwanese. So the Taiwanese basically aren't salting the waters between them and China. A lot of naval mines that will basically stay there, for a long time and basically blow up anybody's ship. They can basically direct the attacks, control the attacks, and defeat a much larger force. Now, this has not been used against a major naval force. China does have a large naval force, but China has never fought a naval war on the high seas. This is new for them. And they're unsure of themselves. One thing you get when you lack that historical experience, which we have, British had before us, is a certain, certainty that if we do this, this will happen. And that's what the Ukrainians have showed the United States and the Taiwanese. And the Taiwanese are looking at this and said, yeah, this will work. This will stop the Chinese. Because basically, they're filling the waters, I think it's 300 kilometers of waters between Taiwan and the Chinese mainland with these Taiwanese-controlled mobile mines, if you will, these USVs. And this is changing for warfare. Most naval battles are fought near a coast. Rarely do you get a naval battle fought on the high seas. One of the exceptions was Midway. But even then, Midway Island was minuscule and did not play a large part in that battle. It was basically sending our carriers out to this point where we believed the Japanese would be. They were there. We defeated them. We sank most of their carriers and basically broke the back of their carrier fleet. The Chinese are up against a similar situation if they try and take Taiwan. The situation in Ukraine has shown the Taiwanese that they have a proven way to defeat the Chinese fleet. And the Chinese, I don't know what they're thinking. I haven't seen anything in public yet, but they're obviously scratching their heads and saying, wait a minute, we have this huge fleet. Now we can't use it without losing it. There you are. And I don't know what the Chinese are going to come up with. I keep thinking of ways where they can do this, they can do that. There's really nothing they can do. They can perhaps send in fake ships, you know, target attrition ships, as it were, to basically take the brunt of the attack and then send in their real ships. But I think the Taiwanese would figure that one out and find a way around it. So in wartime, which is what the Ukrainians are involved in, innovation happens a lot faster than in peacetime. The United States has a problem is that we're in peacetime, but, you know, there are a lot of people in the Pentagon saying, look, we got to think like it's wartime. Look at what the Ukrainians are doing. We can do it, and the Taiwanese know we can do it. You know, we're Taiwan's major ally, and we simply have to do it. And whether or not we will do it, I haven't seen any firm evidence yet that the Taiwanese have adopted this, but it's an obvious solution to their problem of protecting themselves against this new Chinese fleet.
Austin, any response to that?
Jim has gone and pointed out answers, and in some ways comparatively inexpensive answers. And he also pointed out that in Ukraine, especially with the Black Sea operations, which we discussed on a strategy talk, I think, about six, 8 weeks ago, basically that the Black Sea fleet had become the Sea of Azov fleet or something like that.
I think
that was a wisecrack I made or something, but it was the thing is, this was supposed to be a small move, small, successful strike by Russia and Ukraine with an amazing act of citizens in arms stopped Russia's initial attempt. This was the last 3 weeks. And we have seen the operations using the drones, aerial and sea and sub undersea vessels being successful in stalling the Russians. But we've also seen quick depletion of any air and anti-missile missiles. We've also seen the problems with supplying sufficient ammunition. You know, we did a strategy talk on the return of artillery, the god of war. It never went away, but now you see just how powerful it is. And these go back and saying, well, wait a minute. If an adversary targeted your key munitions dumps in Europe and key manufacturing nodes by European nations and took that out, does the U.S. have the ability, as in World War II, to resupply its allies and supply itself? And the thing is, we don't. Since February 2022, we have begun ramping up artillery shell production. And we've even begun building new modern munitions manufacturing, or at least adding it to a couple of our arsenals. There was two European firms, one of them Turkish, that were hired by the Pentagon to help them boost 155mm howitzer ammunition production, because they're tooled. We're going to model ourselves off of some of our allies' tooling, but we lost it. And theirs are forward and more vulnerable, like Taiwan being forward and more vulnerable. And lots and lots of these unmanned air and sea vehicles they look good, and they have worked, but are there electromagnetic environments, in other words, jamming environments, where suddenly not only your drones fail to work, but they turn on you? What about malware and the like, if you're solely relying on quote-unquote unmanned and autonomous combat vehicles, and you lose them en masse? I mean, that's beginning to sound what if and sci-fi, but all this has not been tested in mass. It's been tested in Ukraine, and we've seen what it's done over time. And it's, Jim's quite correct. We talked about this actually 20 years ago, how you stop a Chinese attack on Taiwan is that you seed mines right along the coastline. And there's a scenario there, B-52s, if you could get them in close enough, dropping anti-ship mines in the Taiwan Strait and all up and down the Chinese littoral. To essentially blockade all of the China's sea vessels into Chinese ports, because they make a run for it. They have to go through these large, huge, and intelligent minefields. Okay, these are ideas to forego ideas that would blunt a Chinese invasion or Chinese open ocean operations. But these have not been built yet. They haven't been deployed. We have low missile inventories. They've shrunken because sending them to Ukraine, sending them to Israel, our own ships firing them against Houthi ballistic and cruise missiles coming in to try to, the Houthis are sniping at commercial vessels in the Red Sea. And can we ramp it up? Yes, we can. How long will it take? Well, from what I've read, Jim's got different numbers in this, at a minimum 3 to 5 years. So we're not ready to wage two simultaneous major wars right now, definitely not, with our lack of lack of Air Force fighter wings, because we've reduced so many, and the shrinking of our of the Navy. Yes, there are ways we can boost it, and Jim's outlined and very, very clearly what the cleverness of the Ukrainians in driving Russia's surface vessels, and very likely their subs. There are a couple of things that the Ukrainians have done. They go after Russian subs, anti-submarine warfare, that are clever. But it's also in a closed area, and it's got indications of what could happen in the Indo-Pacific. But it's not been realized. And Jim's right that the Pentagon has said, hey, we need to do this and act like we're at war. Well, we are at war, I think. I think we are in a war with the Chinese. And I've even told you why, a subtle grinding war, with China waging disintegrative warfare against the United States. But all right, we're not prepared for it, but we need to think about it and prepare to be able to fight two major conflicts at the same time. If we have a army and navy of drones that work, more power to us. That might be a far better way to do it. I think mines are a far better way to do it than navy destroyers to fighting the Chinese. But you also have to be willing to have built the mines, have the delivery systems, and be willing to launch an anticipatory attack when the Chinese are making a move at Taiwan. to put those mines down. I ought to add, too, that there are some very, very interesting, quote-unquote, active mines that are essentially drones themselves that are firing explosives, torpedoes, or the like, and they're intelligent mines, intelligent sea mines. The Taiwanese have looked at those and been looking at some of those for over two decades. But are they ready? Are they in place? I don't think so. Have we built enough of them? Do we have enough in the inventory and stockage? I don't think so. And we need to do something about it. If the peril is there, and I think I've made a case that the peril's there, then we need to prepare and need to think about it, because they would be two simultaneous major wars, or could be. They could be two simultaneous major wars. I'll give another scenario where it's not. The big war is going on in the Indo-Pacific, and a strengthened NATO with all 30 members paying not just 2% of their gross domestic product, but 3, 4, 5% of their GDP, because Poland's over 4% now, I believe, on the GDP with NATO. Suddenly you've got modern forces facing the Russians, facing the Iranians, well, not direct confrontation, the ability to deal with Iranian missile threat. And it can be done. We saw the Israelis deal with those Iranian attacks. Good. Then the U.S. and Japan, South Korea, and Australia have a freer hand in confronting communist China. And if you get India in on it, I can bring this up. You know, politics is very important, Dan. It's not just all technology. If India is in a active military alliance with the U.S., Japan, Australia, and South Korea, then China has a huge problem. And maybe you have deterrence, and all of this discussion about could-be wars is they're just going to be could-be, because the Chinese are deterred from making their making what looks like a move that they'd like to make, given their increase in combat power, both with their army and their navy and their air force.
So, Jim, will nuclear deterrence continue to keep the major powers from going face-to-face?
Well, the nuclear deterrence has been a given ever since the end of World War II. Nobody seriously wants to go nuclear because it means everybody gets destroyed. So while it's there and you can rattle the nuclear saber, nobody in their right mind is going to use it. The big difference is the prevalence of cheap defensive weapons. That's where the USVs come in. The Ukrainians have demonstrated it. The United States has picked up on it. Taiwan has picked up on it. If they can produce these in the thousands. I mean, they're cheap. They don't require a lot of manufacturing, fancy manufacturing capabilities. The Ukrainians build them in home workshops. You know, they mobilize the country. In fact, that's where a lot of their innovations in their USVs and other weapons have come from. Individual. You know, any group of Ukrainians, individually, your small groups, they not only come up with these new ideas, but they start turning them out in their own workshops. Like I say, they're using low-tech, equipment and things they can literally manufacture at home. And that's a big difference. And when you have this preponderance of defensive weapons, that's what the USV is. It's not an attack weapon, it's a defensive weapon. You basically checkmate any offensive capabilities, China or anybody else is capable of doing. Now, another thing to keep in mind with the Russians is they're in bad shape. For example, there was a recent example where the Ukrainians found some dead Russians, and they were armed with 1891 vintage Moisin Nagant rifles. Now, they're in pretty bad shape. Yeah, the Russians were pulling stuff out of storage. They were using T-64 tanks last year, and now they're equipping their troops with about 39 million of these Moisin Nagant rifles were built until, I think, 1973. These production stopped. But there's millions of them around, And this is what they're giving the infantry now. And the Ukrainians took on the cross and they said, oh my God, they can't even afford an AK anymore. They're giving him these, you know, these Moisten Nagats, which, you know, which are a bolt-action rifle with a five-round magazine. You know, it's a weapon, but, you know, it's obviously not a decisive weapon. And Russian soldiers are being found dead, you know, with these next to them. So, you know, the Russians are in bad shape. The Chinese have to be careful because they can't depend upon the Russians to do anything in the Atlantic to draw power away from the Americans that are deploying their equipment to the Pacific. Now, the United States is aware of these USVs. I don't know if they started manufacturing them yet. I mean, they should. They'd be stupid not to, because the Ukrainians share information. They said, look, this is how they're built. This is what they cost, you know, $20,000-$30,000 a piece. And this is what they do, and this is what we've been doing with them. So these are not an unknown, you know, new weapon system. They're a proven weapon system. They're a defensive weapon system, and they will basically checkmate any advances China might make. And if China cannot advance, if they cannot, haven't got a good chance to win, they've lost, because basically they depend on foreign trade. They're the second largest importer and exporter in the world, and they have to import most of their food. Now, if their ports are basically plagued by these USVs, by the way, they're jam-proof. You can basically send them out there, and if they detect jamming, they can either, if possible, they'll home on the jammer, or they'll basically go optical. They'll find a target. You know, this is a jam-proof, you know, targeting, and they'll basically just keep going. All you can do is try and, you know, shoot them, and the Chinese are trying to figure out, well, geez, could we send helicopter guns out, ships out there, you know, and shoot them up? You know, they're vulnerable, but they're also very hard to find. Like I say, they're made of non-metallic materials. They're low in the water. At night, you can't find them. You know, you can't detect them visually, and there are no sensors that can detect them. And they're basically the perfect defensive weapon. And with a defense like that, the Chinese have to worry about, you know, not having a revolution inside China, because China's economy is already in bad shape for a number of, you know, reasons having to do with corruption and mismanagement of the Xi Jinping's government. And that's what they have to worry about. And now it's gotten worse, because as they keep acting aggressively, bingo, they find all their ports closed by these USVs. You know, the South China Sea is a perfect area for these USVs to operate, and the Filipinos are aware of them, and they may start building them. And this is a game changer. It's not a hypothetical. It's proven in combat, so you can deploy it anywhere with a defensive weapon like this. Offensive operations are virtually impossible. By the way, in the Atlantic, the Russians are already, how should I put it, neutralized. Their Black Sea fleet is gone. Their Baltic fleet and their Northern fleet are basically vulnerable. The Russians know it. If these USVs start showing up, you know, around Murmansk and what have you, the Northern fleet ports, the Russians are in big trouble, because that's where they have their nuclear submarines. And these submarines, sure, they can avoid the USVs, but if their bases are destroyed or otherwise compromised, they're dead. They can't live forever. they have nuclear fuel, which will last for a long time, but the food the crews eat is limited. If they can't get back to port, or the port is gone, or it's blockaded by USVs, you know, they're dead. So the Russians do what they call a correlation of forces, and with these USVs, it's turned against them. And they have only themselves to blame, because they attack Ukraine. Ukrainians got innovative out of desperation. They invented a new defensive weapon, and it's come back to bite the Russians in the rear end. The Chinese are looking at it, and they're probably, you know, they're undoubtedly scratching their head saying, well, what can we do about this damn thing? You know, this could shut us down, could trigger a revolution inside of China, which is already on shaky ground politically for a number of reasons. So right now, it looks bad for the bad guys.
Well,
we,
Dan, one more thing.
Dan, we don't have those capabilities in mass right now. Now, see, Jim's come up with an answer because it's a 21st century answer to a 21st century problem. The model that I'm using, ETO and, you know, PTO, is the World War II model, but it's we're not in a World War II situation. We're in a 21st century situation, which means we're going to have to, if these weapons can work, and they're being demonstrated that they work, they're going to require deep, large stockpiles of the anti-air and anti-missile, anti-space weapons. We hadn't gone into that, but that's, you know, drones and missiles and aircraft and below. They're going to require large stockpiles and lots of training and integration of these drones to be able to work the defensive miracle that they have worked in the Baltic Sea.
Well, no, I disagree here.
They
are cheap to build. The Taiwanese, as far as we know, are building them already. They can build them themselves. They don't require high tech. They don't require, you know, rare materials, electronics, or what have you. They are basic, you know, cheap to make, cheap to mass produce, you know, weapons. So even if the Taiwanese started tomorrow, if they haven't already, they can have hundreds and then thousands of these out there, and this blocks any prospect of success for the Chinese attacking Taiwan by sea. Now, the Chinese could take a chance. They say, well, now they haven't built up a stockpile, as far as we know. We don't know, because, again, they can be built quickly and in large numbers. You know, we're talking weeks and months, because that's what the Ukrainians did. They started with nothing, and bingo, within a couple of months, they had hundreds of these things, and they had basically defeated the Black Sea Fleet, and the Taiwanese could do the same thing with the Chinese fleet. Now, if they're not doing it, shame on them. But the Taiwanese are not stupid. They are under threat, and the Chinese may realize that, well, if they haven't built up the stockpile, we could attack them now. But the Chinese are also prudent. They say, well, if they have got a stockpile and they can build these things quickly, we'd be foolish, because we'd attack, we would be stopped, not lose, but stopped, which is as good as a loss. And the Chinese people would say, what the hell are you doing, Xi Jinping? You know, we're going to starve to death if these damn, you know, fiberglass, you know, weapons, you know, will close our ports and stop all our foreign trade. We'll be out of work, out of food, and out of patience. And the Chinese don't want that.
I'll go back to what I said again, Dan. This is an answer, and it's a 21st century answer. But it's not available now. Could be quickly, at least in Taiwan turning around. But you've also got issues all up and down the Chinese littoral and down into the South China Sea. South China Sea is a perfect place for many of these sea drones. Jim already brought that up. Need to see them in the Filipino and Vietnamese inventories. Then they become deterring with just U.S. and Japanese backup. But they're not there now. And they could be the answer, may well be the answer, to deterring China so you don't have a super Indo-Pacific PTO, Pacific Theater of Operations type war. But the thing is though, what's good is that we're able to sit here and talk about it and show, you come up with some answers on it, because the problem really does exist.
Well, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you both next time.
Take care.
Bye, guys.